On This Week in Enterprise Tech, open source has revolutionized technology networking, but it really hasn't done much for cellular technology. So we'll talk about how open source just might help impact 4G and 5G networks as well. Curtis is going to bring us some wisdom from RSA and take us through somewhat of the U.S. State Department and what they're saying about fighting against insider threats. Plus, Curtis, Brian, and I talk with a great guest, Ravi Lachman, developer advocate from Harness, to talk about continuous integration, deploying, and delivery, and how AI ops might help. Twyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 382, recorded February 28th, 2020, AI Ops and Hybrid Cloud. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Zapier. Zapier connects all your business software and handles the work for you, so you can focus on what matters most. Right now, through the end of the month, go to zapier.com/enterprise for your free 14-day trial. And by Melissa. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 businesses count on Melissa for clean, reliable address data. Get started today with 25,000 records cleaned for free. That's a $75 value at melissa.com/twit. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Your business may be unpredictable, but your data costs shouldn't be. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in not only the professionals, but the experts in their field, but also the smiling faces at the end of a very long week for me, starting with the smiling face of our very own Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, you've been busy over the last couple of weeks. How have you been?
Actually, my nose is running like crazy because I've been packing, not only at home, but also my lab. So I'm surrounded by boxes. I'm actually trying to sort things out as fast as I can, giving things away, throwing things away. I'm driving the custodians crazy because I keep, can I have some more garbage bags, please?
Well, at least it's just for moving, so that's good. Well, folks, we can't end this week without the smiling face of our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, the senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, it looks like you have survived RSA, even the Bay Area where the coronavirus is an emergency. How are things turning out for you?
Well, I'm doing okay. It's been a good week. RSA has been exhausting. But there have been a ton of great conversations to have, always meet a lot of wonderful people out here. And there were some small visible impacts of the coronavirus caution at RSA. But by and large, the show went on, and I think everybody who attended was very happy that it did.
Well, I think we should definitely do a complete episode for RSA 2020. But to give a taste today, we do have a couple anecdotes in the show, so that's good. But we also talk a little bit about how, you know, open source has revolutionized technology and networking, but it hasn't really done really anything for cellular networking technology. Well, we'll talk about how open source just might help impact 5G as well. Now, Curtis is also going to bring some wisdom from RSA. He's going to take us through what the U.S. State Department is saying about fighting against insider threats. Plus, we have a great guest, Ravi Lachman, developer advocate for Harness. He's going to take us through the modern business and what they should be doing for continuous integration, deploying, and delivering the, that great software and how AI ops just might help you. But first, like we always do, let's go ahead and get into this week's blips. Now, bad actors who want to muck up an election can do plenty of harm without tampering with voter rolls or voting machines. In fact, business email compromise, social media hijacking, and even access to city cameras and traffic signals can cause enough trouble to influence voters and election results. Now, at RSA 2020 this past week, Cyber Reason assembled a group of journalists and of other conference attendees to be in the red team. Now, in charge of basically creating just about enough chaos to cause residents of a fictional city called Adversaria to doubt the results of a fictitious election. Now, did they do it? Well, police officers and city officials led the blue team, defended the election, and responded to deep fake videos and social media takeovers. Now, the 90-minute session represented election day, with each round covering 3-hour segment of the day. Now, the red team got a list of capabilities at the start of the game, which included both city cameras, traffic control systems, local news broadcasts, and emergency warning systems. In each five-minute round, the red team could take two actions and set another task in motion that could develop into a new attack vector. Now, the red team called in a bomb threat to a busy convention center, created deepfake videos of election workers throwing out ballots, turned off the traffic control system in certain districts, and sent false news reports to the TV station about polling places closing down. Get this. After all of that, the blue team successfully defended the elections and minimized chaos. However, what does this mean is what we need to do is strengthen those emergency response teams and beef up proactive security measures for the weak, for weak systems, even in small towns. Now, let's hope some of the learnings of our at RSA can help local governments and big elections at least prepare for the worst and survive.
Cloud Snooper is carrying a rat through your AWS firewall. A recently spotted targeted attack employed a rootkit to sneak malicious traffic through the victim organization's AWS and on-premises firewalls and drop a remote access Trojan, or RAT, onto its cloud-based servers. Researchers at Sophos discovered the attack while inspecting infected Linux and Windows EC2-based cloud infrastructure servers running in AWS. The researchers said the attack appeared to be a campaign to reach ultimate targets via the supply chain, with the current victim just one of several. Now, just who is behind the attack is unclear, but the rat in question is based on source code of the Ghost Rat, a tool associated with Chinese nation-state attackers. Just how the attackers initially hacked into the victim's network is unclear, but Sophos suggests one possibility is that the attackers infiltrated a server via SSH. One of the rare aspects of this attack is that it targeted Linux with a rootkit which was called Snoopy. Had it been called a legitimate file name on the Linux box, researchers say they probably wouldn't even have noticed it.
Well, this is a sad, sad week. One of NASA's greatest mathematicians, Katherine Johnson, has just passed away. Katherine Johnson, a trailblazing mathematician best known for her contributions to NASA's human spaceflight program and who gained fame later in life due to the movie Hidden Figures, passed this Monday. She was 101 years old. Quote, "At NASA, we will never forget her courage and leadership and the milestones we could never have reached without her," said NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. "We will continue building on her legacy and work tirelessly to increase opportunities for everyone who has something to contribute towards the ongoing work of raising the bar of human potential."
Now, Albert Einstein wanted nothing to do with it. He mocked the strange concept of quantum entanglement as a spooky action at a distance. But 100 years on, Einstein's hate could actually help create a more secure internet, thanks to the most reliable technique yet, for entangling nodes along miles and miles of fiber optic cable. Now, with entanglement, an object can be put into quantum superposition of multiple states, and that superposition can actually be shared with another object. Now, in theory, these objects will maintain that connection even when separated, so that measuring one reveals the state of another, no matter how far away they are. Now, this isn't merely of interest to quantum physicists. Now, a quantum internet would allow ultra-secure communication of sensitive messages. One technique is to encrypt a pair of digital keys, a technology known as quantum key distribution, or QKD. Now, if two people both have these keys, they can talk without fear of being snooped on because an eavesdropper would change the state of the keys and be found out. But QKD relies on measuring the state of quantum encrypted keys. Now, that measurement can be affected by conditions in the sending and receiving devices. You need to know their exact physical requirements. That can be impractical because even the tiny material fluctuations can throw off the measurements. Now, quantum entanglement worked across a distance of just less than a mile years before. Now, in the years since, researchers have separated entangled particles by sending them down optical fibers and even up to satellites and back. How far away is the quantum internet, you may ask? Well, researchers in China have demonstrated entanglement through more than 30 miles of fiber coiled with lower transmission errors than ever before. This means that the next generation of internet, I think it's the Web 6.0, just might be the quantum secured one.
Crook hits 1 billion Wi-Fi devices. A vulnerability in the way that two Wi-Fi chipsets handled network interruptions and encryption keys could have given attackers the ability to decrypt some of the network packets sent by more than a billion common wireless devices and routers, including some from Amazon, Apple, and Samsung. At RSA this week, researchers from ESET said that the vulnerability, called Crook and assigned CVE-2019-15126, can force part of the wireless communication between devices to use all zeros for the encryption key, allowing the attacker to eavesdrop on a limited amount of wireless data. Devices affected include older Amazon Echo devices and Kindles, Apple iPad Mini 2, various older Apple iPhones, the Apple MacBook Air, and various Google Nexus smartphones. At least two models of the Samsung Galaxy are affected, as are Raspberry Pi 3, the Xiaomi Redmi 3S, and a number of Wi-Fi access points from various vendors. Now, this is related to the crack vulnerability discovered in 2017, and the vulnerability affects both WPA2 personal and WPA2 enterprise protocols. For more than a year, ESET has worked with device makers to create a fix for the issue and patch devices, but to be safe, make sure you have updated all your Wi-Fi-capable devices, including phones, tablets, laptops, IoT smart devices, and Wi-Fi access points and routers to the latest and greatest firmware version.
So I'm going to be reading an article about a Microsoft product, but I'll just bet you Lou has walked past or driven past Building 83 on the Redmond campus at one time or another. So Building 83 really doesn't stand out. You know, I've driven around the campus, and it's a really big campus in Redmond. But anyway, the other week, the nameless structure, this thing, Building 83, hosted what might be Microsoft's most important product of the year 2020. So tucked away in the corner of one of those meeting rooms, a sign was reading Election Guard. And it identifies a touchscreen that asks people to cast their votes. An Xbox adaptive controller is connected to it, as are an all-white printer and a white ballot box for paper votes. If you didn't look carefully, you might have mistaken all that for just an array of office supplies. So Election Guard is an open-source voting machine system that Microsoft announced in May of 2019. And in the Microsoft demo, voters make their choices by touchscreen before printing out two copies. A voter is supposed to double-check one copy before placing it into the ballot box to be counted by the election workers. The other is a backup record with a QR code the voter can use to check that the vote was counted after the polls close. So in reality, this is what gets me a little excited, is with Election Guard, Microsoft isn't setting out to create an unhackable voting system. You know, we all know that might not even be possible, but rather a voting system in which hacks can be very quickly noticed.
Now, the Secure and Trusted Communication Networks Act was approved in voice votes by the House in December and by the Senate yesterday. Now, it doesn't mention Huawei or ZTE by name, but it does say the FCC must produce a list of equipment providers, and these providers could be, quote, posing national security risks, and prohibits ISPs and phone companies from using FCC funding to purchase, rent, lease, or maintain equipment and services made by the companies listed. Now, specifically, the bill directs the FCC to create a $1 billion reimbursement fund for ISPs that have 2 million or fewer customers. Now, the funding would be used for, quote, permanently removing, replacing, and disposing Huawei or ZTE gear and equipment from any providers that added to the prohibited list in the future. Now, the FCC was already seeking public comment on how to pay for removal and replacement of equipment, but hadn't created a fund. Now, to help ISPs find replacement technology, the bill directs the FCC to develop a list of suggested replacements of both physical and virtual communication equipment, application, and management software. Now, the list is required to be technology neutral, and the $1 billion would presumably come from the FCC's existing Universal Service Fund. Now, Huawei in December sued the FCC in an attempt to stop the ban, but a U.S. District Court judge ruled in favor of the FCC. Now, U.S. government officials recently said they have, quote, evidence that Huawei has the capability secretly to access sensitive and impersonal information in systems it maintains and sells around the world. But they haven't made that evidence public, and Huawei said, quote, has never and will never covertly access telecom networks, nor do we have the capability to do so. Now, what it does seem is the U.S. government is out to rid our infrastructure of Huawei equipment, but it might not be enough to convince the big players and ISPs out there to also incur the costs for the same thing. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Zapier. Now, growing a business is hard, right? Well, especially when you're wasting hours and hours every day removing data or moving data from emails to spreadsheets to your CRM and back and forth. It should be easier than that, right, in this day and age? Well, I know our sales organization needs an easier way to connect the system and the stream of data with systems that can really help organize and provide deep insights in the next steps with customers. Well, Zapier can help here. It is the easiest way to automate your work. It connects all your business software and handles the work for you, so you can focus on the things that really matter, right? No more wasting your time on tasks that you know could be automated, because that's exactly what Zapier was built to do. Just go to our special link, zapier.com/enterprise, connect the apps you use most, and let Zapier take it from there. Now, let me tell you what also Zapier can do. It can instantly engage with leads, send them to a CRM or spreadsheet, then notify your team so they can act fast on every opportunity. And that's just scratching the surface of what Zapier can do. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so the possibilities are virtually endless. Best of all, it's easy to build the exact solution you need in just minutes without writing code or asking a developer to help. Super powerful platform. Join more than 4.5 million people who are saving an average of 40 hours per month by using Zapier. I can tell you Zapier is a great tool. It can literally connect your data from point A to point B, and it can literally save you time and money. I could definitely have tried this out, especially since I work for the Access and Excel team, and I can tell you it works great with these applications. Try it out today. Right now, through the end of the month, try Zapier free by going to zapier.com/enterprise. That's zapier.com/enterprise. for your free 14-day trial. Zapier.com/enterprise. And we thank Zapier for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into this week's bites. Now, open source has literally revolutionized technology, right? And it's not only technology, but networking as well. But it hasn't really done too much for cellular technology. Well, why? Well, because what Boris Rensky believes, co-founder of OpenStack and Kubernetes power Mirantis, the cellular wireless networks has limited competition and is a black box primarily due to historic government regulation. Is he right about that? Well, however, there might be a light at the end of the tunnel now that the FCC has opened up the 3.5 gigahertz citizens broadband service, or the CBRS. There is now room for new open source based companies to offer 4G LTE and eventually 5G voice and data. Now, is there anyone willing to take the plunge here? Well, of course there is. Without risk, there isn't reward, right? Well, Boris Rensky has decided to be the one of the pioneers here. Now, what is the largest advantage Boris thinks the business can change and what he can highlight here? Well, it basically destroys the biggest barrier to competition and innovation in the cellular wireless space and gives access to clean wireless spectrums. Now, the price of entry ticket to build a mobile network just changed from millions of dollars and years of FCC paperwork to $0 and a single API call. So along with some developers from Facebook Connectivity, he is working on an open source Evolved Packet Core, EPC. Now, this, in brief, is a 4G LTE take on software-defined networking, SDN. We've all heard of that. Now, some open source programs address the back-end needs for an open-source cellular network. These are Open RAN and Magma. His new cellular company is called nothing else but Freedom Fi. All right, guys, I want to bring you in. Cheebert, I want to start with you. Now, I tell you one thing. With an API-driven on-demand licensing of 5G radio spectrum, this can literally open-source cellular wireless and open the floodgates, can it? It can literally make it so that multiple companies can jump in here and do it themselves. Is that right?
You bet. The industry really got started with MVNOs, basically the Cricket Wireless and people like that, where they literally buy tons of minutes and data from the big carriers. Well, there's a problem with that. The entry to that is huge, big, big money. Well, when we start playing with CBRS, and there was a lot of talk about CBRS at the recent conference I went to, the Wispapalooza, sorry. And CBRS has some really, really interesting potential. And this particular open source approach starts opening up some very, very interesting things. So cellular, typically when you open the connection, it's just an open pipe. You shove as much or as little data down it as you want, but you're paying by the megabyte. Now, what happens when you have Internet of Things devices where you only need to send a small number of bytes, you know, like things like temperature, humidity, or maybe just temperature of a water heater or a leak sensor, or how much water is a resident using, how much electricity is it using. These are really small pieces of data and they don't have to be sent very often. An API like this means you can negotiate through the API, and you should be able to go and say, I have this bundle, send it. And I'm going to leave the connection closed until the next time I need to do an update. So when you start getting into this, you start getting into, say, some models where, say, for instance, water is a really good one. You have a model for the day, and you can send a heartbeat, say, once a day on how many thousands or hundreds of gallons a residence has used. But you might be able to go and do a model. So this is my science hat on, and you can just say no change to the model. And I'm only going to send a larger amount of data when the model changes. So by having an API, I can negotiate that with the carrier and I don't have to go and say, I need 2 gig a month or I need 1 gig a month. You can basically say, I just need to go and send 10 bytes, please. And so that's going to change the way we do things, and it's going to make wireless connectivity of Internet of Things a really, really interesting place to do business. And you know what? I think that's going to be a retirement wireless project for me. And you know, Kurt's been trying to convince me that I should be doing a wireless sensor network for the Everglades so we can try and preserve that endangered habitat.
Well, if it's as easy as Boris says it is, it might just be options there. Curtis, I did want to throw a question to you because Boris is a salesman, obviously. He's co-founder of OpenStack and Kubernetes Power Mirantis. He definitely knows about how to sell things, especially when it comes to startups. Let me ask you a question. How black box has cellular networks been? Is it really that big of a problem? And is this really going to help?
Cellular networks have been a problem because the equipment to become your own, even small, cellular data network is not cheap. And you have to negotiate not only a lot of technical issues, but a bunch of licensing and regulatory issues, because pretty much every hertz of available commercial space is spoken for. But what I think this does is open up the possibility for the incumbents, you know, primarily the big three, to take some of their older spectrum that is, they are hoping to use less as 5G comes online, and lease it back to you for the kind of projects that Brian was talking about on a very low cost basis. Because let's face it, these usage models would allow thousands and thousands of different devices to be interleaved on the same bit of spectrum and not run into each other and not, you know, tax the bandwidth of the land-based infrastructure very much. So I do think that for a lot of sensors, for a lot of small-scale control applications, this has the potential to bring some tremendous changes to the industry, and especially in things, as Brian said, like monitoring remote conditions, and I think as well in things like agriculture, where you're going to be looking at microclimate data and perhaps even control of things like drip irrigation that today, because of control issues, have to be taken care of through flood or really large spray application.
Jupiter, I want to throw it to you for the last word here. What do you think? Going to help? Going to make a difference?
Here's one thing. This is actually more of a wish. I don't know whether he's going to pull it off, but this is a big wish. My biggest complaint about cellular networks is like when I gather data, say, on Maui from power usage, that has to jump onto the cellular network, and my APN happens to be in Fort Worth, Texas. So my data has to go all the way to Fort Worth where it finally exits to the public internet so it can come back. So my data has almost a 7,000-mile round trip to get logged into my server. Well, when you start having SDN-type, software-defined network capability in your cellular network, maybe, just maybe, I can have regional devices that are kind of like APNs, so that if I have a long-haul trucker or if I have a ship, a cargo ship, instead of having to go around the world to update a server where my location is, gee, wouldn't it be nice if I could go to a regional center? So that is another promise, and that will dramatically reduce the latency on things for like security devices. So that has one heck of a lot of promise, and I'm crossing my fingers.
Let's hope Boris succeeds and he truly opens the door for more innovation all over the market. But I do want to move on to the next bite, because Curtis is going to bring us some wisdom from RSA 2020. Curtis?
Well, at RSA this week, we heard a presentation in which the U.S. State Department shared insider tips to fight insider threats. Part of the basic wisdom is that every employee is a potential threatening insider. Now, that can be through malicious means, through accidental means, but the potential is always there. The State Department was trying to point out that organizations with the right steps, processes, and procedures in place can both prevent a person from going rogue and detect it when someone does go rogue before it's too late. Now, this is not just a tech problem. It's not just a security issue, and it's not just a personnel issue, said one of the speakers. When an insider threat takes place, businesses can't go back and change what happened. The best they can do at that point is to remediate and then look back and see the indicators that should have tipped them off so that they can prevent future threats. These markers can be spotted at all stages of the employee cycle, the speaker said, a process that typically looks the same for pretty much every industry across every company across every industry. And there are a number of steps that are included, steps like hiring, vetting, training, inclusion support, and security. Now, one of the really important things they said is that you want to help the employees feel wanted, feel a part of the organization. And you can't start the process with IT. IT is the last line of defense when it comes to information leaving the network, and not the first. What they want to do is you need to support, give the employees policies and resources that are in place to help ensure that the employees have the support for professional, personal, or financial stress that might hit them. If an insider accidentally breaches security rules or takes files outside the organization accidentally, it could easily be due to external circumstances that cause them to behave different than normal. A fancy way of saying something could be going on in their lives that distracts them. They say that managers need to manage and engage. Supervisors, they say, are the best defense against insider threat behavior. There's a difference between an introverted employee who wants to go alone sometimes and an isolationist who exclusively keeps to themselves all day. Now, in addition to engaging with the employee and helping them feel part of the organization, employees should be properly vetted and properly trained during the hiring and onboarding process. You know, if you find that an employee sends an email with company data outside the organization, for example, you should consider whether they have completed the training on the issue, whether that particular scenario was covered in their training. These are critical before you can decide what to do in response to the employee. Now, to get to this point, the candidate's resume, the interview, and references can be instrumental in gauging their risks. Even though everyone who hires know that references are, well, they're touchy these days. Still, when you ask for one, listen to the response and try to gauge the tone of voice. Try to find out if the person providing you what will almost certainly be a very bland statement of start and stop dates and employment, how do they sound about it? The insider threat can appear at any part of the employee cycle, but by the time the threat takes place, it's often too late to detect it in time to prevent it. Take the ideas of helping employees feel included, feel supported, and then wrap that in some technology to help remind them of all these things. It's going to lower your potential risk and help make sure that these insider threats don't become insider disasters. Now, Lou, I'm curious. I know that you manage people. How important do you think it is to help the employees feel like they're part of something, that they're not just, to use old language, just a cog in the wheel, that they're actually part of a team where the human beings matter to them?
You know, I think it's the most important thing, because I think, you know, a lot of organizations, they tend to consider people as resources. That's how they measure them. That's how they budget for them. They don't really consider the person themselves, the goals of that person, whether they're happy, what they actually want to work on, how they want to grow, you know, these types of things. And so because they just consider them resources, they just kind of throw people at projects and things, not really thinking about kind of the skill sets and the current kind of, you know, where the employees are at, both in their career and, you know, in their personal lives. And so I think that This is a really super important thing. I've done this for years. I've had a really good set of coaches that, back in the beginning of becoming manager and a director is that, you know, they tended to say, hey, listen, you know, your people are super important. And, you know, a company of this size, they tend to have a lot of churn and turnover because, you know, they don't want to just be that person that comes in and does work. They want to be working towards something bigger and that they feel like they're working towards something that they believe in, they have passion for, and that they're growing during that process. And so I think that's a really important thing. And if you don't have that, you'll like this article is showing, and even at the study at RSA is showing, is that people will show signs of that. They will show signs of the fact that they don't really enjoy what they're working on, or they feel like they're just coming in day in and day out in monotony and not really enjoying what they're doing, or they have a lot of problems with the way things are run. So I think that, you know, there are signals that are coming from people that could potentially be signals that they could, you know, be opening the door to potential even data threats or even to other things. And so these things you have to pay attention to. But I think that a healthy organization is definitely one where people feel like they have a cause and they're part of the journey. And I think that's what I try to do, especially with all of my teams, for sure.
Well, Brian, I know that you have worked in organizations where insider threats were taken very, very seriously. How important did you find training, you know, proper education of the staff, and then refreshing that training to be in making sure that people didn't accidentally become an insider threat, you know, much less from some malicious motive?
Well, you know, training is always a big deal, and the sad part is it's never. I've never worked for any organization where training was actually an important budget item. Whenever times are hard, training was one of the first things that got chopped. And that's just asking for trouble. Now, so one of those organizations I used to work for, we had an acronym called MICE. And that's an acronym that stands for Money, Ideology, Conscience, and Ego. In the training, it was the major motivators for people committing treason, spies, and so forth. But if you take a step back, it's also a really good reason why people take shortcuts. If you're ignoring people, you're not investing them, you're not making them feel wanted or valued, you're going to start getting this old, you know, thing, like we had this saying, oh, such and such isn't afraid of hard work. He can sit next to it all day long and it doesn't bother him one bit. So when you start ignoring and not valuing your employees, you start getting people figuring, why bother? You know, I'll just do the bare minimum. And that really affects things like security. If you're not going to take the time, you're not going to take the value to go and get through that checklist to do the job right first time, you're asking for trouble. And how you treat your employees is going to have a very, very big effect on how careful they're going to be.
It really is amazing just how powerful the simple concept of treating human beings as humans can be. You know, in the same way we don't ask ourselves how we're going to motivate a chair to hold us up, if we don't think of humans as people, but instead just as resources, as Lou said, we don't worry about things like motivation and feelings. We treat them as, well, just another brick in the wall. I'm thrilled to see experts talking about the importance of treating people and helping them not just make the right decisions, but follow the proper procedures so that they are less tempted to become intentional threat actors and less likely to become accidental threat actors. Well, that's it for this bite. Tell you what, Lou, I know we've got a great guest. How about I hand it back to you to take us off in that direction?
Thank you, Kurt. That's right. Before we get to my favorite part of the show, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. We do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Melissa. Now, what can really hurt businesses? Well, bad data, of course, and that's where the leader in address verification comes in and helps you. Melissa, now every address is covered from Adelaide, Australia to Zipaquita, Colombia, and everywhere in between. Having run numerous businesses and ones that depend on data, I can tell you that there's nothing good about bad data. Nothing good. Not only does it cost money, it hurts sales, it decreases customer satisfaction, it can literally hurt a business. If bad addresses, duplicate records, and bouncing emails are hurting your business, I think it's time to come clean with Melissa. Don't only take my word for it. Check it out. Delta Faucet, Z1 Motorsports, and Cartago, who actually use Melissa. Now, Delta Faucet was able to improve their call center processes with global address auto completion. In fact, Melissa was able to reduce the fraudulent e-commerce transactions for Z1 Motorsports by 90%. Now, Melissa provides a full spectrum of data quality protection for your customer data. Verify postal addresses, mobile numbers, and email addresses. Update the addresses of customers that have been moved and eliminate duplicate records. Gain additional customer insight into your data with Melissa's analytics. Now, easily build address verification and customer data validation in your custom applications using Melissa's APIs, CRM cloud connectors, and e-commerce plugins, or you can upload your customer file for quick data cleanse. Now, Melissa is serious about securely managing your data because they continually undergo independent security audits to reinforce their commitment to security data, privacy, and compliance requirements. They are SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. Now, mailers spend about $20 billion annually in undeliverable mail. That's right. That's a lot of money. Don't lose customers or cash. Make every address count. Bad data happens to good companies. That's why 10,000 organizations worldwide trust Melissa to get their customer data clean and accurate. Get started today with 25,000 records clean for free. That's a $75 value at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit or call 1-800-MELISSA to find out more. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Ravi Lachman, developer advocate from Harness. Welcome to the show, Ravi.
Hey, what's going on? Thanks for having me.
We're so glad to have you here. Now, our audience really, really loves to hear origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a quick journey through tech and how you ended up at Harness?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been a long ride to get to Harness, but kind of like in high school, I had a home business. I used to make kiosk applications, and then I went to university to kind of button down my software engineering skills. I spent time in university at IBM. I actually wanted to be a technology writer, but writing Java paid more than writing words at the time, so I got into Java development for about a decade. Kind of was told I talked too much, so I went from a product engineer to a consultant to an architect to a pre-sales engineer. And finally, at my firm ago, how I started getting into developer relations and developer advocacy was that I just gave a talk about burritos and cloud native computing because I like to put food in all my talks. And someone thought it was funny and said, you can do this kind of like full time if you want. And so that's how I kind of ended up at the company before I came to Harness. And then, you know, being at Harness, I really enjoy helping people learn about continuous delivery, one of the most challenging parts of a software engineer's job.
Fantastic. Well, I do want to get into that because I know DevOps has been a lot of pretty big topic on This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we know it's not an easy thing. But I want to first start on the other end of the spectrum. Some of the things that we don't know about that are actually coming to market to actually help DevOps and help the CD and CI pipelines. Can you maybe take us through what AIOps is and what it can do for organizations?
Yeah, for sure. So AIOps stands for Artificial Intelligence Operations. So it's one of those phonemes, right? So something with ops at the end. and so really what AIOps, it has to do a lot with cognitive science. And so it's actually mimicking decisions. Let's say us four on the show were a team. It would mimic what we would do, right? And so it's using a lot of technologies that have been manifesting itself in other areas for consumer-facing tech, and now it's starting to enable enterprise tech, right? So a lot of the learning curve, a lot of the toil, we can actually have systems make decisions that would mimic our response to certain things like slowness and outage, making crucial decisions. Even more so since RSA is going on, you might have heard of a platform called a RASP, right? So a runtime application security platform. Like those are all things that include AIOps mantras in them.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is, and I'm very familiar with build services and having to deploy and continuous deploy them. I tell you, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, whether a deployment pipeline is breaking or you're just not getting it deployed to the right nodes or you know, somebody checks something in that's bad and it gets deployed anyways. What are companies doing to fix these problems? Because these are things that companies struggle with day in and day out. What is there a silver bullet here?
I don't think there's one silver bullet. I'll give a little bit more long-winded answer. You know, just from the previous talk, I really enjoyed the talk about motivation when you were discussing what was happening at the State Department. You know, as a first-time people manager myself, like motivation is key. If you take a look at who the consumer of these systems are, like or there's internal clients like software engineers and developers who have to use these platforms. A lot of the toil, I would say, learning curve, as I went through my career, it wasn't necessarily knowing a development language, but it was how do I deploy something? How do I get a release in? Like that was always where the angst steps in as you change projects. And so what is industry knowledge might be a development language. What is tribal knowledge is actually your deployment pipeline. It, everybody does it different, right? If we were to interview 50 different companies at different sizes and different maturity models, most people would have a different answer. And so what is industry convention for a development language is necessarily each application's unique. And so there's no silver bullet. And this is why you're seeing such a increase in, let's say, innovation and spend in building a pipeline, right? So some of the facets you mentioned there, hey, you check something in, a build happens, it breaks at some point in a safe manner. Everybody's marching towards that because I think it's one of the last frontiers of tribal knowledge in the enterprise, in enterprise IT. And that's becoming more convention-based with the investment in continuous integration and continuous delivery solutions. So a lot of work still to be done.
Now, I think one of the interesting things is a lot of companies, you know, whether it's AWS, Microsoft, Google, they're trying to sell this concept of a silver bullet called serverless technology, service as a function or whatever they're calling in whatever sector you're in. Is this something that would really help businesses here and really is get you closer to that target? Or is it just another notch in the difficulty of DevOps and CI/CD pipes?
It's let's say you separate the two, right? So like I've done some Lambda of Amazon, right? So like development before. And what the allure is for a developer is you get to see rapidly what your changes are. So if you pick a development language, it's almost instant invocation, at least for your function that you're writing. And so where it muddies the waters is people sometimes forget the discipline that your SDLC has. So this is where your DevOps process comes in, right? That actually makes it harder. If I was a software engineer and I had, let's say, some sort of Node.js Lambda out there, I'm like, I don't need to go and run tests. I can directly edit it, and it's available in production in seconds, right? Versus it is an infrastructure paradigm. And so it makes the importance of the team even more important. It's one tool to do a job, but absolutely don't forget your confidence building steps, which is a lot of times in your CD pipeline.
Now you work with a lot of customers out there. What some of these complex services are, you know, whether they're retailers or they are large organizations that supply vehicles, or they are organizations that provide code tools. What are some of them are doing, and how are they handling some of the complexities, especially around the fact that there is difference between continuous integration, continuous deployment, and then there's this other thing that kind of lingers off to the very side, which is delivering it to customers. How are these companies handling these types of things?
Yeah, I would say like it's definitely like a spectrum, right? Like, and also a maturity curve. It's a problem that no matter what industry you're in, it's a problem. I can talk to a startup, I can talk to a value firm, I can talk to a big technology, like even a product company. And it all has to do with the human element, right? So my personal opinion, the whole point of the SDLC is a confidence building exercise, right? Like that's why you test anything to make sure your features match the expectation. So starting with CI, what you mentioned there, so continuous integration is basically build, right? So there's a concept that I'll personify a software engineer here. So if I were to check in some code or make a change, can I have a build? That's been going on for a long time. I've worked on projects a decade ago that we had a build every time someone would check something in. Now the stack has changed, but that was a going mantra. And kind of going down to the first CD continuous deployment is if I were to make a build, how quickly can you get it into another environment, right? So now I have a build artifact. Can I rapidly get that into another environment? And finally, the last CD, that's the stuff that I kind of dabble in most. It actually brings back in the human element. So again, pretend we're a four-person company on the show here. It's each one of us will have different expectations of how, you know, what should be the proper way of reducing risk, what should be the proper way of like ensuring safety in our deployment. And so it's really taking human-centric approaches and automating that, saying, oh, do I have to get an approval? There's a lot of industries out there that still have to get approvals as, you know, being in the Valley, sometimes it's automate, automate, automate. But for a majority of firms, there's someone who has to sign off on something. That might be an electronic sign-off, or it's automate everything but the button push is a common mantra we hear with banks and other regulated industries. And that's actually very, very difficult to do. And that's where continuous delivery steps in.
Well, folks, I do want to get more into this because obviously DevOps is a big topic and there's a lot of things to cover here. And I want to bring my co-host back in. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, I can tell you I've developed a ton of projects on Wasabi, and I can tell you that some of the unique super features that they have, you're going to want to try them out right now because cloud storage is readily available today. But you might be thinking, I already use cloud storage. And the more I store in it, the more I access it, the data, the more operations I perform on it, the more I get charged. Well, in this day and age, that's kind of the story that most cloud storage companies have. But most cloud storage providers are really just competing to see how low they can go on storage fees and ingress and egress fees. Well, Wasabi has a solution here, and they add a ton of other features along with it. Now, from experience, I can tell you the cheaper cloud storage systems you go to, you also give up on performance and reliability as well. Well, Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage has a way to fix all of these things. From small personal projects all the way up to the large enterprise ones, Wasabi has figured it all out. And let's start with the cost because it's super competitive. It's super awesome. Pricing is $5.99 per terabyte per month. That's it. That's a super competitive price across the market today. Plus, listen to the game changer here because it's literally going to change how much you pay for things. Unlimited free egress for your data. That's right. No charge for API calls. You don't have to pay to actually access your data. Now, check out what you're already paying for cloud storage because I can tell you that not having to include egress fees and API calls for those CRUD operations will substantially save you money on the cost of doing business. Now, you also probably think, well, if they are cheaper, they must actually be slower or they don't have all the bells and whistles, right? Well, Wasabi has a way to tackle all of those areas. They have developed a disruptive technology that found ways to actually pull raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising anything. And they've revolutionized the process that lays down data on disks sequentially as opposed to blocks. And what happens with that? Well, that means that Wasabi's storage is 80% cheaper and 6 times faster in speed than some of the industry leaders. Now, is your organization worried about compliance? Well, Wasabi is HIPAA, FINRA, and CGIS compliant as well. Not only does Wasabi offer fast, inexpensive storage, but there are also a bunch of other features not talked about by other storage providers that Wasabi provides out of the box. In fact, they have enhanced security because that's one of the biggest ones because Wasabi follows industry best practice models and security models and design practices here. Now, they offer a unique feature called immutable buckets of data that cannot be deleted or altered, which actually protects your valuable data from accidental or malicious destruction. Now, with these buckets, they have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and access control lists, and they can be used to selectively grant permissions across your organization. Now, not only that, they also add 90-day rotating integrity checks, and they provide 11 nines of durability. That means, on average, you lose one file every 649,000 years. That's a pretty good amount of odds there. Now, to give you more peace of mind, Wasabi has found was founded by industry storage legends David Friend and Jeff Flowers. And, of course, Wasabi's revolutionary technology is built from their deep experience in the space as the founders of cloud backup market leader Carbonite. Now, data storage is all Wasabi does, and they are the experts. It's their passion. They believe that in the world of rapidly escalating cloud storage needs, things only move forward if cloud storage is treated more like a utility with fast, affordable storage available in endless supply. I bet you want to try this out right now, right? Well, go build something fun or move some of your data right now. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com. Click the free trial link and enter the code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure to use the offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Kurt, I want to jump to you first. I want to bring you back, guys, back in, but I want to jump to you first because you were just came back from RSA. What is going on? What was going on with DevOps at RSA?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we did see a number of products and services built on and around containers, things that promise to help with the management of containers, to automate the deployment of containers, to instrument containers, to analyze containers. So my question is this, with what you're doing and what everyone else is doing, how close are we to being in danger of making Kubernetes and the associated infrastructure so heavy that we lose a lot of that light and nimble quality that has made containers so valuable to this point?
I think the good thing about computers, they always get more powerful, right? And a lot of the investment in containerization is actually for portability also. And so if you're able to have more horizontal scale, right, for your applications or vertical scale, depending on how you're architected, computing can keep up with what's needed. So but back to your point, though, there's a lot more process being driven into it. So I'll kind of keep like a security focus in my response here. So there's a lot with light development. There's this concept called DevSecOps, right? So there's this mantra of shifting left being the developer or development team. And so a lot of it's just providing knowledge to folks as they're being exposed to different packages. You might, you know, when you're building a piece of software, you might be interacting with hundreds of packages and you only have knowledge of a dozen because those are what you directly touched. To kind of the heart of your question there, I don't see that happening. What might take time is the initial deployment, right? So the initial scan, just go back to continuous delivery, your initial scan, your initial risk assessment, but ongoing, I don't think it's much overhead. You can be able to scale the application appropriately.
Well, I think that one of the keys to my next question is whether you are seeing your customers move containers into full deployment. You know, containers have been, for the last couple of years, a technology where we've heard a lot about them, but when you poke at the companies, they admit that they're using them in the dev process, and they're testing them, perhaps, doing proofs of concept for deployment. Are you beginning to see your customers actually use these in production deployment scenarios, or is most of it still back in the dev world?
I would say most of the folks that I talk to, either be a prospect, a customer, or someone, you know, with no relation to Harness, has some sort of containerized technology in production. A lot of the work that's happened, I would say, you know, containers are not new. Solaris had zones, right? And so that's always the funny story that people think they're a newer thing, is that technology, the surrounding ecosystem, so VARs, like software vendors, people have been pushing them to deliver container solutions just because aforementioned technology, Kubernetes, right? Some people might standardize on that and say, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Vendor, you know, if you want to run your software in our four walls. We need to give us a container that runs or an image that runs in Kubernetes. I would say that most of the folks that I talk to have some sort of strategy at this point. There's multiple ways to run a container too, right? There's, you know, things like Amazon ECS, there's Mesos, there's Docker Swarm, there's this running Docker run at that point, right? And so I would say that the workloads are certainly catching up. The application platform is certainly catching up, but I would say that it's pretty easy to spin stuff up, especially in a public cloud vendor today, to get some sort of usable workload.
Okay, so we've been talking about the technology. Now let's go talk about harness. If we have some viewers that want to get into harness, look at it, and help them automate or control their hybrid, let's call it a hybrid environment. Mm-hmm. What kinds of steps, what kinds of inventory, what kinds of things should they think about doing as they jump into talking to your people?
Yeah, I think there's a level of like maturity and process that folks have to have. We talk with such a wide spectrum of people. Like we talk to startups that have a few folks, right? To enterprises that are in the Fortune 10 or Fortune 1. And it's everyone needs to have a kind of like a grounded view. Ironically, the smaller you are, the easier it is because you have total control of your technology stack. The bigger you are, you might be burdened with decisions that were made before your time, to kind of the heart of your question there. At least be able to build in an automated fashion, right? So using something that if you were able to trigger something that would produce a build, that's usually a precursor for us. If you don't have a solution in place like that, you know, at least for now, it might not, you know, it might be an overkill to be using Harness. The great thing about Harness, I represent the Harness community. And so we actually have a free version, a free forever version of the product that, you know, you can just sign up with your GitHub or like LinkedIn or Google credentials or OAuth credentials and just sign up and start using the product. We have a lot of folks who kind of do that to get their hands dirty. And also it's actually, since it's such a production grade tool, you can run workload off of it. But really making sure you have some sort of way to build your application artifact. And then the great thing about Harness, we're not very picky about where we deploy to. So some other solutions are very cloud native focused, like you have to be using Kubernetes or you have to be using some sort of cloud native orchestrator. You know, we play well in both worlds. We play well in the cloud native world. And also we play well in the more traditional, I hate to call it traditional, date myself, the traditional non-cloud native on-prem infrastructure.
Fantastic. Ravi, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little low on time, but we did want to give you an opportunity to maybe tell the folks at home where they can learn more about DevOps, learn more about AI ops, and also especially about where to go to get started with Harness.
Oh, absolutely. Just you visit our website, www.harness.io. We have a fantastic blog. We have several, you know, awesome contributors that we do have. And also, just go into our community website, community.harness.io. There's me, my latest post. it's doing this live, yeah. So really great resources there. We're going to be launching another website soon, which is more of like a playbook for software delivery. So stay tuned for that. And yeah, really excited. Come learn with us. You know, this is a problem that's really challenging for a lot of folks to solve. And it's kind of ubiquitous across the board. No one solution has really figured out, but we have a lot of purpose-built people at Harness just marching towards that goal of solving this for everybody. So exciting times.
Thanks so much for being here, Ravi.
Cheers.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 AI bops. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise, Chibert. We love hearing from you. We love knowing what's going on in your week. Tell us what's going on. Plus, where can people find you and get a hold of you for show ideas?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB. And love to hear from you on show ideas. I am also Chibert at twit.tv, or better yet, why don't you use Twiet at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. Love to hear from you. Love to hear your show ideas. Right now, I am just armpit deep in boxes, just trying to pack up. This is actually my last month of employment with the University of Hawaii, and I'm getting ready to join the fixed income crowd as I become a retiree.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, you're back from RSA. I'm sure there's a bunch of content coming out from that. People love reading your stuff. Where can they go and find you and all of your work?
Well, people can always find my work at Dark Reading, and especially at the edge of Dark Reading, where my features and more, oh, we'll say creative flights into the world of security can be found. You're right. I do have a bunch of stuff coming up in the coming few days and weeks, including a number of pieces on topics like assigning quantities to risk and measuring third-party risk, which is a very serious issue for a lot of folks these days. For a pointer to all of my stuff, check me out on Twitter. That's at KG4GWA. And you can even find me occasionally, at least on Instagram. That's Kurt_Franklin. Look forward to seeing each and every one of the Twiat Riot, all of those places.
Thanks, Kurt. Thank you guys for being here. But folks, we have to thank you as well. You're that person that drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and to listen to our show and catch up on your enterprise news and IT news for the week. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and more importantly, next to the videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links as well. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, or your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or any one of your favorite podcast applications, of course. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, and we want you to subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, and your coworkers with sharing Twiat with them as well. Remember, we definitely want you to subscribe, but we also do this show live each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. We do it at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. Come see the behind the scenes and all the banter and fun we have here at Twit. But of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room live as well, irc.twit.tv. We love the chat room. We have great discussions there and during and after the show. So come and join the crowd. Join the movement, jump into the chat room as well. Now, if you can't watch the show live and you still can't be part of the chat room live, we also still have an amazing community after hours as well. Come join the 24/7 discussion on our new community location at site, twit.community. That's right, twit.community. All the hosts are out there. The Twit community is out there. We have great discussions on content and hosts and guests and all different technology discussions. Just come out and join the technology discussion in the Twit community. It's really a great place to be. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you'll see all my posts on enterprise tidbits. I have really great conversations with people like you. Plus, you get to see what I do on my normal work week at Microsoft there as well. And you can always check out dev.office.com. There we post the latest and greatest ways to customize your office and as well as customize ways Office can be more productive for you and your organization. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit, and especially thank you, Mr. Brian Chi, one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. Thank you, Brian, for all your hard work and getting the show together and all of our guests on here. So thank you for all your support. But before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, you got to tell us, man, what was the spirit of today's show, the essence of today's show? What did you learn?
Well, from seeing the response that Java and Burritos got in the chat room, I think I'm going to open up a new co-working space and just call it Java and Burritos. I think it'll
do
great.
You might actually make quite a bit of money with that, for sure. Yeah.
I think I'll have to clear Ravi, though. I think that was his term, right?
very good, sir. Well, I would say you were super close, but that would be AI ops. But maybe next time we'll definitely check you out and bring you in next time. Maybe you can get it. All right. Thanks so much. And until next time, I'm Louis Moresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.